A media analyst quoted earlier this year in the New York Times, quote, "Rupert has his mojo back." Rupert Murdoch on Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge on thewallstreetjournal.com. I'm Peter Robinson. When his father died unexpectedly, Rupert Murdoch, then 22, inherited an afternoon newspaper in Adelaide, Australia, The News. Some six decades later, Mr. Murdoch serves as chairman and chief executive officer of the company for which the Adelaide News served as the foundation, the News Corporation, overseeing media properties now on five continents, including the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, the New York Post, and 20th Century Fox, the Los Angeles film studio where this interview is taking place. Rupert Murdoch, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Segment one, the new News Corporation. You announced last spring that you intend to split the News Corporation in two. One company, which will continue to be called the News Corporation, will be devoted to publishing. It'll hold HarperCollins, the book publisher, and your newspapers. The other company, which will be called the Fox Group, will be devoted to entertainment. You spent your life building the News Corporation. Why split it in two?
Basically, it's very interesting. To start with, I resisted the idea for a long time, but what it's led to is really better and more intensive management of all these assets. And instead of just thinking, well, there's a lot of money coming in from cable television and we can keep the newspapers, it wasn't as bad as that, but we really are now in this new company looking at the whole business model of newspapers, what we can do, what digital developments we can make. It's a great opportunity.
The Economist magazine, quote, "Investors so distrusted the moguls' devotion to unprofitable newspapers, everybody knows you love newspapers, that for years a Murdoch discount has dogged the company's share price." So that's the pressure from the market that you're referring to.
Yes.
The markets wanted you out. Newspapers, unprofitable. Why do you want to be in that business?
Oh, I think they can be a great force for good still. And do a lot of things, and I think, you know, they've just got to change their business model, and that's what we're about. We're thinking about that very hard, and in fact, working on it and going forward. You know, if the advertising is going to decline, and it is, it has declined, a lot of it, like small ads, I don't think will come back. We have to look to our readers to pay us more, so we have to get the better products. We have to have digital versions, which we charge for properly. Maybe start all sorts of new things, which will be tied into the newspaper apps.
All right. Now, preparing for this interview, I live up in Silicon Valley, as you know. I asked a number of friends what they would do with your newspapers if they were in your position. And those friends said, sell them. Fast. You've got a situation now in which advertising revenues have declined, but the rate of decline has slowed. So for some number of years, newspapers will provide a modest but reliable source of cash, effectively coupons. And the reason for selling them now is because private equity companies with the economy in uncertain shape are sitting on a lot of cash. This is the perfect moment to sell those dogs, get rid of them. There's no real growth in them. So what I'm trying to get is whether you won't sell them because you so love them. And you said earlier, you can do a lot of good with them. And it is an important fact in understanding your life that one grandfather was a preacher. You do feel yes, a duty to do good with what you own.
Oh, absolutely.
Or do you say, whoa, 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 the market is wrong. I've been in this business all my life. I see opportunities the market is missing.
Well, I think both. I do see opportunities, but we'll see how it develops and how we go. But we've got people working on all our newspapers now really enthusiastic about the future, and it's great. But, you know, it is difficult. The economies we operate in, less so here perhaps, although I'm not optimistic, but they're very difficult in Australia and in Britain. That affects circulations. And we're moving more and more to a subscription model, as we have here with the Wall Street Journal.
I see.
Where well over 90% are subscriptions paid for by credit card every month, just as really every newspaper in America is.
While we're still with newspapers, one success story and one not so successful story. You mentioned the Wall Street Journal. You bought that paper in 2007, circulation about 2 million.
That included the digital side, yes.
Right. Circulation today, just about flat. But by comparison with the other members of the 10 top circulation newspapers in the country, maintaining a flat circulation represents an enormous triumph. Nine of the 10 others,
yeah,
all have dropped circulation. The New York Times over the same period since 2010 is down circulation 20%. So the News Corporation purchases the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal does something no other major newspaper in the country does, which is to hold its own in a very tough climate. How did you pull that off?
Well, I had a brilliant editor. I'm going to really give him the credit for it, Robert Thompson, who incidentally will be the chief executive of the new publishing company.
The new News Corporation.
The
so
new
to speak.
News Corporation, right. Yes. And he's gathering a team around him. But he really did it and slowly turned it around, turned the staff, changed a few people, and then introduced new sections. I mean, you look at when we bought it, they just started the Saturday edition. And everyone was very divided in whether this was a waste of money or a mistake or not. We've made it far the best read of all. And we've added sections, really distinguished book reviews.
Book reviews, Washington coverage,
and
sports.
And leisure activities we call off-duty.
Right.
So it's something for everybody there.
So you've just made it a fuller, richer experience.
Absolutely. And I think daily,
the daily,
we've been on the news. We have, the Wall Street Journal didn't mind often if they were a day late, because they would take the news. They'd spend a lot of time writing long pieces, sometimes very well done, but people would say, oh, I must put this aside and keep it, but never get to it. Now we try and keep it much more urgent. It's about, what happened in the last 24 hours.
Right. Right.
And what is happening in the world on a bigger scale.
The not-so-success. iPads, smartphones, e-readers, lots of people expect those to save newspapers. And you and Apple, in a joint venture, developed The Daily, a newspaper, I think that's the right word, but no newsprint, a newspaper intended from the very get-go for the iPad. And 2 years and $40 million into it, you pulled the plug. What went wrong there?
It was less than 2 years. But,
less than 2 years.
And it wasn't a partnership. It was us. It just didn't catch on. I think, if you needed, an established brand. Now, you take the number of people who pay real money, this was a dollar a week, who pay real money for the Wall Street Journal or the London Times on their iPads, or even the New York Post. It's very, very different. If they're good and good-looking and they feel like the paper, they feel everything is there, people will pay for it.
Last question about newspapers.
Very often, they'll keep buying the paper and they'll buy the app on the iPad, which is not cheap, because they've got something mobile to take with them.
But so is it fair to say that the failure of the Daily reaffirm the value of your major brands?
Absolutely.
It's very hard to invent a brand. The Wall Street Journal means something to people and has for decades.
Yes.
The London Times means something and has for centuries in the case
yes.
of the London Times. Those brands are powerful. That's right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Last question about newspapers. After you graduated from Oxford, for a few months before you went home to Australia, you did a stint with the Daily Express, working for one of the great, the most colorful press barons in British history, Lord Beaverbrook. And in those days, I've heard you talk about it, the romance of putting out a newspaper, it was almost factory work. Setting the type, inking the rollers, the great crash and the hum, the thrum in the whole building when the presses would start to run. These days...
Well, there was a lot more to it than that, but that was the romantic side, yes.
Off the romantic side. These days, any kid with a computer can start, in effect, a newspaper. What I'm getting at is, in the old days, you had to have capital. There were very serious barriers to entry. Before anybody launched a new newspaper, everybody in the business knew about it because he'd been around to bankers and he'd been buying equipment. And so, and these days, the capital requirements are essentially zero. So what?
Well, they've got to start and they've got to produce a product. They've got to employ a lot of people. It's not just any kid. A kid can take a, you know, do a blog, which can be very interesting. But that's not a newspaper.
Right. Well, so that's what I'm getting at.
Or someone can steal a lot of stuff from the existing newspapers. We have that problem.
So that's what I'm getting at is, what have you got in the 21st century when the technology has changed so dramatically? What is it that you have after six decades of placing your life in this industry that represents a distinctive and competitive advantage about the new News Corporation?
Well, and we have a lot of experience in producing newspapers and a lot of feeling about where they fit in the society, and you know, different papers in different ways. And they do undoubtedly still carry a lot of influence. I think probably not as much influence as politicians, who are paranoid about them.
As politicians suppose?
Politicians, every country, they worry about what's in newspapers. I think more than the readers. I mean, readers, if they enjoy the experience of reading a paper, they'll buy it even if they disagree with it.
Right.
But you can stimulate discussion, you can, you know, change the agenda, that sort of thing, a little bit.
So you've got brands, and you've got 60 years of experience, and those are not easy to duplicate.
Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe, you know, younger people are very good. Take someone like Robert Thompson, who's 30 years younger than me. He's great. He understands it totally. And so do other people, like Jerry Baker, the new managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. Yes, sure.
Segment three, the Fox Group. How did a newspaper man end up assembling one of the biggest and most profitable film and television companies on the planet? You began complementing your newspaper holdings with broadcast properties way back when you were in Australia. Mm-hmm. So you've got a few newspapers and then you purchase a television station. What? Clearly, faster than other people of whom I'm aware, you understood that these properties were complementary, but in what way?
Oh,
Would throw off cash when the other needed cash, or what?
Yes.
How did you?
No, we could see very clearly that television is going to be a powerful medium, and it was going to take a lot of money out of the advertising pie. I think that's why every newspaper, from the Washington Post to our little paper in Australia, wherever you look, tried to get into it. In Britain, it was a little different, although they were in it early. The BBC was so omnipresent and controlling of everything. Newspapers were slower to move on television. But it was the common sense thing to do. And now, of course, first it was to save ourselves, and then as we got into it, it was to create more choice, more variety. We have you know, a lot of cable channels here. They're going to 100 million homes. And some with very big, powerful audiences, like Fox News, and others like our main broadcasting network, which goes out to the whole 110 million homes in America. That doesn't do much news, but that's entertaining. And is it, the idea that is, when we started it, we thought, look, there's room for more choice than just three networks.
Right.
Now, of course, the problem is the average home gets 80 to 100 channels, some more if they pay extra. So the audience is being fragmented. So it's become, in some ways, quite a difficult business. Mm. If it's just for cable and you can charge the cable companies for carrying it for every home they go to, it's a very good business, or it can be a very good business.
The Fox Group accounted for 9/10 of last year's operating income. And the big performer within the Fox Group is the Fox Cable Network programming, and above all, Fox News. This brings us back to Fox News. From an analyst report, quote, the cable programming division's performance accounts for 28.5% of News Corporation's revenues and 60% of its operating income. You launched Fox News in 1996. Today, Fox News has more than twice as many viewers as its two nearest competitors, CNN and MSNBC, combined. From zero, from a startup, to nearly $1 billion in profits.
Certainly has more. I don't know if it's exactly double if you add the two together, but never mind. It's way out in front.
It's good news for Fox, whatever way one slices it, right? So what I want to know is, how did that happen? What makes... First question is, where did you have the audacity in a very settled television environment?
Well, it was a rather rash idea. I said, let's try it. And everybody said, no, there's CNN has been there for years. There's no room for more than one news channel. And we tried it, and we put a different viewpoint, if you like. I would say we were fair and balanced. People laugh at that and say, no, you're very right-wing. In fact, you'll find just as many Democrats as Republicans on and so on. And whereas you'll only find Democrats on the others, or more or less. But it's really given comfort and voice to the big conservative, the normal American conservative, working class people, particularly people in the countryside. They love it.
Right. So what interests me is you said
a lot of character to it. Roger Ailes, who runs it, is a genius. The way he balances everything and manages to control his celebrity stars. But it's very good.
But you said a moment ago it was a rash decision.
At the time, yes.
And you said, well, let's go ahead. So this is another, to me, this is another interesting aspect of your character. Even as one grandfather was a preacher, the other was a well-known gambler. Am I not correct about that?
Pretty much.
And there are moments in your career, in fact, a lot of moments in your career, where it looks to me as though Rupert Murdoch just says, oh, what the hell, let's give it a go.
That's true.
That's true?
My father used to worry that I'd take after my mother's father, the gambler. But there's certainly a bit of that in my genes, I'm sure.
All right. So Fox News is on the air since 1996. And CNN's relative ratings drop, MSNBC's relative ratings drop. The puzzle to me is everything Fox News does, it does in public. There are no secrets about how you do what Fox News does. It does it on television.
Right.
Why is it so difficult for anybody else to get the hang of it?
Well, I don't think they're bad. You're seeing big changes going on at CNN now. They've got a new head of it, and they're popularizing it, if you like. Instead of
moving in your direction,
instead of having the Ted Turner saying this is the New York Times of the year, they're not. They're CNN, and they're using helicopters and running around, being much more pop, if you will. I don't say they're politically any different than what they've always been, but they're just the way they present. They've sharpened up a lot in the last couple of months.
All right. 20th Century Fox, one of the six major film studios in Hollywood. Last year, 20th Century produced Life of Pi, 11 Academy Award nominations, congratulations, and co-produced Lincoln, 12 Academy Award nominations, congratulations. I know you love going to the Academy Award events.
Well,
yeah. No, I'm just joking about that. But despite these two enormous hits, over the last several years, revenues at 20th Century Fox, relatively flat. How do you take, what do you do with a movie studio? What do you do with a studio?
Oh, we've been consistently, certainly the last 5 years, pretty much equally the most profitable.
Mm-hmm.
Warner Brothers and ourselves. I think mm-hmm. three out of five, we just outpaced them. Two, they just beat us. But very close. But we stand right above all the others. Disney's about half that. And then you go down to sort of also-rans in terms of profits.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can say, look, there's vast turnover here. And often there's no profit. Life of Pi, which everyone thought we were crazy, and it took years to make,
hugely expensive,
and a lot of money, has now taken $600 million, or will in the next week or so, go past $600 million at box office around the world. Now, Lincoln, which I enjoyed very much, and I thought great acting by Daniel Day-Lewis, I think it's taking about $175 million here. If it wins, it'll probably go to $200. Internationally, we'll be distributed. It's less than that, because mm-hmm. it's very much an American thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it costs less than Life of Pi, but we'll will probably certainly make less money.
And so 20th Century Fox is still in the big, expensive, the business of big, expensive productions and hoping for a blockbuster.
Oh, we try not. Look, we have a lot of pretty commercial films that some are very expensive, some are not. It depends. But if you build a franchise, it's good. But and we have, you know, an animation division, which actually is on the East Coast, mm-hmm. which makes a film about every year. We've had, I think, three series of Ice Age.
Right.
Very, very profitable.
I know my children rent them over and over again from iTunes.
Good.
One more rumor, but it's a rumor with a pedigree because it comes from the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal's story on News Corporation's last earnings call, Chase Carey. Mr. Carey discussed the possibility of launching a national sports network, which he called the worst kept secret on Wall Street, close quote. Are you going to go up against ESPN?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's done.
Definitely. No, but we're way down the road on planning, and we've announced it too.
All right.
I mean, we have a thing now called the Speed Channel, which is basically NASCAR. That's going to be converted into Fox Sports 1, and we'll have a lot of sports. Probably won't have NFL because that's so expensive, but it'll be very bright and a very interesting alternative to ESPN.
Segment 4, education. Bill Gates spends his foundation's money on healthcare. Other philanthropists make donations to universities. But perhaps the central concern of your philanthropy is schools, not universities, but K-12 schools. I know you devote a lot of time personally to the Harlem Village Academy, for example. Why? Why
well, schools? Not enough time. I think Amplify is a big thing now.
Amplify is your education company.
It's going to be an education division of our new news corporation.
Of the new news corporation.
I just believe that in this country, and for that matter, it has been true in Britain, although they're improving a lot at the moment, but this country is a crime. Look, right here in Los Angeles, 50% of the kids in public high schools drop out 2 to 3 years early. They're never going to. I mean, they're committed forever to the underclass. In Newark, it's the same, 50%. And I think it's just, it's criminal what we're doing to this generation. We are not educating them as well as the previous generation. And this has been going on and getting worse. And this Amplify, what we're doing, it's going to be all electronic. It's a really new way. It'll work with teachers. We help teachers tremendously. But we're putting classes, we're developing classes, K through 12, which will all be sort of animated on a tablet or iPad-like device.
Completely electronic curriculum.
Absolutely. Right? Yes, absolutely. And we're testing it now and with 5,000 kids across the country. Just the first, 80 hours or so of material that we have finished. It takes a lot of work to do this.
And how much investment have you got into that already?
Well, we bought a company that has a lot of technology for over $300 million, and I guess we've spent the best part of another $100 or $200, and we will continue to spend at that rate for 3 or 4 years until we get sufficient acceptance mm-hmm. through enough school systems turn profitable and potentially very profitable. There'll be opposition, but you get the big traditional publishers who, like Pearson and
McGraw-Hill
and so on, who have had excellent textbooks, but their response to this is to sort of turn their old expensive textbooks into a digital delivery. We're really trying something much newer and build into these things. Great teachers' aides, and so on. It's really fascinating.
Right. We heard earlier that investors were worried about the so-called Murdoch discount, that investors would pull their hair out because you love newspapers too much. And now the question is, we've just heard you talk about education with deep personal passion. Is Amplify going to be a business or a cause?
Oh, both, I hope.
Both, okay. And you don't see any contradiction?
No, not at all. Look, investors don't like new things and risky things, and they're not going to like this new News Corp as a share for some time. We're going to have to prove that we can have rising profits and do a job and develop new products, electronic products, and so on, before we get really recognized by the market. Whereas Fox Group, I think, will just go up and up.
Right.
If all our plans go on in cable and so forth.
Segment 5, The Fighter. Rupert Murdoch in the News Corporation 2012 annual report, quote, "Over the years, I have become accustomed to the noise and negativism of the naysayers."
That's right.
Explain that.
Well, there are always people. So this won't work, that won't work. And, you know, we started very small, so we had to take gambles. We had to take on things which were nearly broke and turn them around and fight our way into the marketplace. Whether that was getting out of Adelaide and going to Sydney, or whether it was with the London Sun, because the Daily Mirror was selling 5.3 million, and the London Sun, they owned it actually, but it wasn't a tabloid even. We took it and probably saved about 600,000 readers, and it went out. And almost from day one, people were, we used television advertising for the first time in Britain and so on. It went over a million, and then it was a question who would get to 3.5 million first, us going up or them coming down. And now, yeah, we've all, those are the third one started. It doesn't sell many. The Daily Star, but we've got 2.25 million daily, more on Saturday, but 2 and 3/4 million on Saturday. And the Daily Mirror is at 1 million, or most days under 1 million. It's very interesting.
It is very interesting. Now, when you founded The Australian, first national newspaper in the country, you went up against entrenched newspaper interests in Australia. You buy the Times of London, and you took on the British Oxford-Cambridge establishment. They did not like this crude foreigner moving into their turf.
Well, I don't know, that's true. Yes, quite a lot of people.
There was some of that.
Oh, yes.
There was a lot of that. And then when you founded Fox News, you took on the media establishment here in the United States. But all this is very odd. You were born into a leading Australian newspaper family. You attended Oxford yourself. When you took on the media in the United States, by that point, you already owned quite a lot of media in the United States. Why didn't you ever just settle down and enjoy life as a member of the establishment?
Oh, I'm not that type.
Why do you feel this need to tip things over all the time?
Well, I think, you know, it's great to be, if you're sure of what you're doing, to be a little radical, be an agent of change. And, you know, we're not forgiven in Britain. There's a lot of this trouble we've had recently, been motivated by the right and the left. You know, they remember we supported Thatcher. They remember we broke the unions in London, the print unions. And I think, as far as the right went, and the far right, like Lord Panmure, the great sin that we committed was starting Sky Television, because that would like a challenge to the BBC.
Right.
And we were out of control. We started it from a satellite, a Luxembourg satellite. And we very nearly went broke on that. Very nearly. And the establishment started another one, and they did. They lost heart. They lost a fortune, more than us. And we came together and merged, and then they all went away, but one by one. And we became a public company of great value. And we have 40% of that today.
Of B Sky B.
Yeah, and it's doing a fabulous job. It's got hundreds of channels on the air.
You mentioned a moment ago.
Some I'm sure just aren't watched, but it's interesting.
Oh, you mentioned a moment ago Ronald Reagan, whom you knew, and Margaret Thatcher, whom you knew very well.
Mm, yeah. Yes. I didn't see a great deal of anything like that, but yes.
She could get you on the phone, and you had a meeting of minds.
Well, any prime minister can get you on the phone, but she didn't.
You could get her.
I don't remember ever calling me, yeah, I would call on her occasionally, maybe once a year.
Well, a quarter of a century, 30 years after Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher left office, is this where they would have hoped the United States and Britain would be?
Not at all.
What's
I think
gone
they
wrong?
Feel it slid a lot.
What's gone wrong?
In Britain, I think the welfare state is out of control. And it's very, very interesting. And here, if we're not careful, I was reading today of a woman with two children. She only makes $19,000 a year, but with food stamps, subsidies from state and federal government, welfare, she's getting the equivalent of $85,000. Now, you know, that's why we're going broke. We had a story the other day. We put it on page one of the Sun, which caused a tremendous stir, of a woman with 11 children from three or four fathers, all, the whole thing was welfare. And the local council had just spent £400,000 building her a house big enough. And it was very interesting. I think she felt the pressure. She wasn't stupid. She went on the air and said, well, maybe she ought to do something different. But you know, the resentment of this from working people, there's a lot of working people in this country and in Britain who are finding it very hard to make ends meet. And I think it's another problem here in this country. There's always been a problem of class and things in Britain, but it's different. Here, if you read their book, Coming Apart, by Charles Murray. Really worrying what's happened over the last 50 years. It was only about amongst the white population. But the rich got richer. The kids go to...
fancy schools.
Yeah, you know, Ivy League schools. They marry other kids from Ivy League schools. Their kids go... And then you can see where they live. They're all in the same set of zip codes with other people, a privilege of some sort or other. Whereas the 80%... it's really gone, it's terrible. It's gone from 5% to 40% single mothers. They don't see the chance to break through. Previously, I mean, 30 years ago, yeah, when we go to church together, there were Boy Scouts, there were people mixed. Right. And there wasn't a resentment, and there wasn't there with these extremes. And the answer is not, I think, just to say, look, you've got to flatten the rich. The answer, they've got to take their share, but... it's education. Just people have got to have get through, you know, a good high school education to start with.
Right.
Then they're on their own, whether they go to special occupational sort of schools or whether they go to college or whatever. You've got to not only make these young people from poverty homes aspirational, we've got to help them with that starting education.
Rupert Murdoch in the News Corporation 2012 annual report once again, quote, this is you, a free and democratic society depends on an educated public. Well, that's exactly the business we are in. We help our customers gain the knowledge they need to get ahead in life and make informed personal choices, close quote. You're in the democracy business.
That's correct.
Is that the way you see it? And how, I'm going to read a tweet of yours. By the way, you started a Twitter account just over a year ago, and you already have 400,000 followers.
Yeah, it started as a bit of a joke and a lark.
Well, it's...
and then my family was horrified, and so other people said, no, it's a good idea. Just express yourself on serious subjects occasionally, and people will see that you're not the sort of caricature figure that most think you are.
February 3rd, 2012, Rupert Murdoch tweets, Ray fiscal stimulus, no. And again on the same day, inflation alert. Big central banks printing huge sums money, failing to produce jobs or manufacturing. Very dangerous times. Close quote. How dangerous?
Oh, I think very dangerous. You know, you don't get out of recessions without the formation of lots of small businesses. And today, you've got a really lack of political leadership in all three countries we're in. And people feel uncertain. They're not prepared to risk everything, borrow money and start and employ 30 people or 40 people. That's one side. The idea was with this money, pumping a lot of money out, it could stimulate things. It hasn't. It stimulated speculation. That's why, you know, the price of oil is at least $20 a barrel more than supply and demand would suggest. Mm. I mean, we've seen today's headline, the price of gasoline across America has gone up 50 cents a gallon in the last month. Now, excuse me, that has got to be a drag on the economy. Working people have to drive to work. Working people, just even if they're just driving to Walmart, they're using gasoline.
Right.
And if they're, if it's 10% costlier, that's less money they have to spend. It's a drag.
So then, let me...
If all commodity prices get pushed up by speculators,
coming to
because money is so cheap, it's so easy to borrow money.
Coming to a few final questions here, one big final question. You started your career 6 decades ago, so you've seen the Cold War come and the Cold War go. You participated in the Reagan years. You were a journalist of importance in the Thatcher years and since. You've invested in China, you've invested in India. You have a global view and a global view that's adjusted, calibrated to decades. Do you look at the United States and Britain today and see yourself in the position, let's say, of St. Augustine in the 4th century, 5th century, as he looks across the Mediterranean to Rome and realizes that his civilization is coming to an end? He still has a responsibility to do as much good as he can, but that something that he treasures is ending. Or do you say, I've seen a lot of rough patches in my lifetime. We're in another rough patch now. But the underlying dynamism and strengths of this Anglo-American experiment in democracy will see us through yet again.
Oh, I see the latter. I think, you know, sure, we're in a rough patch, but with help, yes, I think we will get through.
So you're an optimist.
I'm an optimist about the future.
Right. Last couple of questions.
There's a lot of nonsense going on about a lot of things, but I'd recommend anyone to read The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley, which points out that through all the rough patches of the last 100 years, the average living standard every citizen, that includes people who have come out of poverty, has gone up by 10 times. 10 times. If you think 100 years ago.
Right.
What things were like. How many people had, inside toilets or whatever.
Right.
It's really amazing.
Right. Right.
Now we're seeing that there's sort of breakthroughs that are coming in biotechnology and so on. It's really a very exciting future.
A couple of last questions, one of which is mandatory for anybody who interviews you. You have 3 adult children, Lachlan, James, and Elizabeth, each of whom is now a very accomplished media executive in his own right. At the same time, you have reportedly told your biggest outside shareholder, Prince Waleed, quote, I'm going to stay on as CEO until I'm 130. So, as
I'm
I say,
more realistic than that, really.
Last question. Bill Gates put in his last full-time day at Microsoft at the age of 52. You have no interest. You and I have talked about this. You have no interest in putting in your last day anytime soon.
What Bill is doing. I mean, I think some of the work he's doing, malaria, yes, HIV, have been incredible.
But what keeps you
very
at it?
Very generous.
What keeps you at it?
But I just love it. I have busy, very busy days, and it keeps me stimulated, keeps me curious. That's the way to stay young.
Rupert Murdoch, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the News Corporation, thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson.